Here we go. Vertigo, test for echo. It's episode 121 of the Planet LP podcast. Hi, hello. Thanks as always for listening. I'm Ted Asfargadu, your intrepid host of this pod since 2021. And if I live on in some kind of AI matrix, I may be hosting this podcast well into the year 2112. Well, if you're catching some Rush-related references, you're in the know about what I'm talking about. Heck, you just have to read the title of this episode to know what I'm going to be talking about. It's Rush, the Canadian power trio who's been rocking the inhabitants of planet Earth since their 1974 self-titled debut album. Well, it's been 11 years since Rush seemingly called it quits. The death of drummer and lyricist Neil Peart in 2020 just reinforced the fact that the band was no longer. But we, the collective we, were wrong. In October 2025, Rush announced that they were going out on the road again with a drummer that very few, if any, folks saw coming to celebrate 50-something years together. Bassist and vocalist Geddy Lee, guitarist and sometimes vocalist Alex Lifeson, Annika Niles on drums, and Lauren Gold on keyboards, we're going to do a very Rush thing, play over 2 hours each night and tour North America, parts of South America, the United Kingdom, and Europe. I'll admit that I was skeptical about it, and I was angry about how much the band was charging for tickets. But what's a Rush fan going to do but spend money on their favorite band? And that's what I did. I plunked down over $300 a ticket for close to nosebleed seats at the Kia Forum in Los Angeles. And I took a friend of mine with me. That friend is Dan Reed. He used to be the drummer in a rock band called Overwhelming Colorfest. Dan is a fan of Rush and really wanted to see them. So I said, hey, you will be my guest. I'll come to LA and we'll see the show together. And we did. So what follows is a two-part conversation with Dan, one before the show and one after. Before we get into it, I'd like to mention that Planet LP is sponsored by Steve Fox's Old School, classic soul, R&B, and hip-hop from the golden era. Steve Fox's Old School. It's a party in a box. Listen at stevefoxoldschool.com. That's stevefoxoldschool.com. So I am at the Pierce Brothers Westwood Cemetery in Los Angeles, California, with Dan Reed. Dan,
how you doing? Ted, glad to be here.
You might remember Dan from the episode I did featuring his band called
Semprini.
Semprini, the great Semprini. Dan on drums, his brother Bob on vocals, and we
Dan on bass and Marty Schneider on guitar. Yeah,
got to give all credit to where credit's due. We are going to the Rush show tonight at the Kia Forum in Los Angeles. This is the last night of their four-night stand in LA, which they have surprised fans with different sets every night. So we're hoping tonight we're getting the fourth version of their
primo.
Yeah, the primo
select choice cut.
And you're hoping that they're going to play what?
Hemispheres. Anything from Hemispheres will make this old man happy. Yes, perhaps even the entire first side.
All right, old man, I'm going to ask you your Rush origin story.
All right.
Well, when did you come to this band? How did you come to this band? I'm sure you kind of foreshadowed it in the album you just talked about.
My brother, in the late 70s, 79, was in a band with a guy named Jim Silva. And Jim Silva was a guitar player. And he had a Rush record. And my brother had come home from band practice and was saying, I heard this band today. They're really cool. They're called Rush. And the album was like Blue. He's like, I forget the name of it, but it was really good. They're really killer. And I'm like, oh, right on. That's cool. So I started thinking about it. And I'm like, all right, the hell with it. So I went down to Rock Bottom Records. And
you gotta explain where Rock Bottom
in beautiful sunny Antioch, California.
Okay.
The original location, which was where Wendy's is now. If you're from Antioch, then you know where Wendy's is. And there's a little strip mall there. And
I can guarantee you that most people listening to this podcast have no idea where Antioch, California is.
Perfect. Okay. It's in the middle of Illinois. Anyway, So
of California, the Illinois part of California.
And since my brother didn't tell me the title of the record, he just said it was a blue album. And I'm like, okay. So I start flipping through, and lo and behold, they have two blue albums, All the World's a Stage and Hemispheres, their most recent release. And All the World's a Stage was like $7.98, and Hemispheres was like $5.98. And because I was cheap, I bought Hemispheres. And I went home and I put it on and proceeded to have my tiny little 12-year-old mind blown to a million pieces in just every direction possible. Yeah, I had to repaint the walls. My mind was blown.
Okay, you and I are about a year apart. You're younger than I am by 1 year.
Sure am. Yeah.
I can't imagine at 12 years old listening to Hemispheres as my first Rush album.
Your introduction,
because that is probably their most complex album.
It absolutely, absolutely most complex. And I think that that bar got set so high that it made it tough for me to like enjoy records like, you know, Grace Under Pressure and further on, because they were just so pushing themselves so hard on that record. I mean, you know, the next record I bought after that was Caress of Steel, and it's still pretty complex considering, you know, it's a little, you know, sort of that blend between where they were going and where they'd come from. But yeah, and then I think Farewell to Kings was the next one I picked up after that, and that was another one that's super complex and just tiny mind, tiny junior high mind blown.
Okay, my tiny junior high mind was a fan of the band Kiss. Probably from 6th to 7th grade.
And that's perfectly legit, because most people were at that age. It was just what we did between 76 and 79, 80. It's like all the dudes love Kiss, man. It was our band, right?
Yeah.
That was just it.
So. I'm just amazed that Hemispheres was your first Rush record.
And it was totally accidental. Yeah. And it was just like, I had just gotten my bass, and there was no way I was trying any of those bass parts at all. Not even close. I was just trying to learn how to play Black Magic Woman by Santana. And it was just like, dude, there's no way. But the first time I challenged myself was when Permanent Waves came out, and trying to do that bass solo on Free Will. That do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, that part. Yeah, eventually I got it, and then...
Practice makes perfect, right?
Practice does make perfect, so there you go.
And as Geddy Lee once said, practice is a dirty, rotten trap. Man, the more you do it, the better you get. Then you're trapped into practicing all the time.
You're stuck.
So my first Rush album was not Hemispheres. It was Permanent Waves, but it wasn't mine. It was my brother's.
Okay.
So he had it, my brother Steve. I only listened to the first two songs, and I've talked about Rush on this podcast many times, and I've told this story about how he was the program director of his radio station at high school, and he got a promo copy, and he brought it home, and I looked at the cover, and I said, "Who's this?" And he goes, "Rush." And I said, "Are they any good?" He said, "Yeah, why don't you listen to it and see it for yourself?"
Yeah.
Okay, so I only actually knew two songs, but when I became an absolute fan of the band was when I saw them in Oakland on the Moving Pictures tour. So I went into that concert only knowing two songs, and the two songs were off of Permanent Waves. It was the first two songs, Free Will and The Spirit of Radio, not in that order.
Did your brother drag you to the show, or was it like...
No, it was some kids from high school.
Okay.
They had an extra ticket.
Nice.
And it was a random thing. We were just talking, and they said, "Hey, we're going to go see Rush in a couple nights. Do you want to go?"
Wow. And you know, that's the thing. I remember going back and forth to the Bass Outlet at Sears in Antioch, going back and checking, no tickets on sale, they're sold out. What? Like, you know, time after time.
This was the Moving Pictures tour?
Yeah. Okay. And I was so bummed out that they were gone like that. Like, there was like, the guy working the counter wouldn't even say like, "Oh, they're going on sale soon," or nothing, just going back, and they're gone. I was so crushed. I mean, I was so ready to see them when Movie Pictures came out. So I'm glad you got to go. That's so rad.
It was amazing. I mean, it was nosebleed seats, but it didn't matter because they just were so good. Short story on this.
Yeah.
The tickets were $10.50.
Yeah.
The guys never asked me for money.
Really?
Wow. Until about 5 years later.
Yeah.
My brother Steve had a mobile DJ company, and I would help him out. So we were DJing like some church dance. And this dude walks up to me. He goes, "Hey, I know you." And I said, "Hey, how's it going?" He goes, "You remember me from high school?" I'm all like, "Oh, yeah." So what do you say? Where's my 10 bucks? He goes, "Where's my 10 bucks for Rush, man?"
Oh.
And Fortunately, we're paid in cash back then, so I gave him his $10.
Did he want the 50?
No. He didn't charge interest either, which I thought was pretty...
He must have really needed it to remember that.
He really was like, where's my $10?
I don't know. Pulled the whole, don't you remember I brought all the joints joke, and that could have got you out of it, maybe.
I did get high at that concert, but it was a contact high.
That would have been a perfect comeback. Yeah, remember that for next time, okay?
Yes, okay.
Some guy's all, hey, remember 1982 when I bought you tickets for Oingo Boingo and you still owe me $7.50?
So when was your first Rush concert?
I didn't see them until Power Windows. That was what, January?
86.
Yeah, okay. That was my first Rush show. And then I saw them again when they did the tour with the EP. You know?
Oh, Feedback.
Yeah, Feedback. I saw that tour. And then I saw the Time Machine tour. I took my son back in 2011.
Yeah, that was a good one, too.
Gorge in Washington, yeah.
That's when they played Moving Pictures in its entirety.
Yeah, and that was
which
awesome.
They did the other night.
They did that the other night.
It's like, what a surprise. Amazing.
Camera Eye has always been one of my favorite tunes. And it doesn't break any doors down there, but it's just such a great tune, just such a great vibe, you know what I'm saying?
Totally.
And
you know what's kind of interesting about that song is that, and I don't have the source, but I remember hearing either or reading that Neil Peart, or a quote from Neil Peart, or it may have been Geddy Lee, saying that that's their least favorite song to play live, that is, because it's not as challenging as the other songs.
Yeah.
But now they say it's one of their favorite songs. So
and
I don't
ironically,
know.
Ironically, the band that gave up playing challenging songs after Hemisphere, after pushing themselves to the limits, is now bored with their songs that are somewhat long and complex.
Well, they knew they kind of had to ride the new wave a bit.
Yeah, they were a little bitty. Yeah, they were getting on that new wave train. Signals, now that's a new wave record, but it's a damn fine record.
It's a very good record,
That's my last favorite Rush album, beginning to end. I like 70% of Power Windows. Grace Under Pressure, makes a good chafing dish holder, but you know that's about it. And I know a lot of people that love it. It just never worked for me.
It was half a good album, I think.
Yeah.
Grace Under Pressure. I love Power Windows though.
Now, did you listen to that new mix on it? Terry Brown.
I did.
I think we talked about that.
And thanks for reading my Popdose review about it.
Yeah.
Really appreciate you.
Yeah. Well, you know, somebody's got to carry the torch, Ted.
Did you listen to it?
Yeah,
I actually reviewed it. For the casual listener, like I said in the review, they wouldn't notice. But if you've listened to this record over and over for a lot of years, when you hear the Terry Brown mix, you will hear things that you didn't hear before. He brought up certain things. He brought up more of the guitar, which I think
was important.
Yeah. I think that Alex Lifeson at that point really felt kind of sidelined because Geddy Lee's love affair with keyboards and synth and all that.
And I think that's one of the reasons I didn't like it, because I felt like they were just too in your face, and it like didn't, the balance of the band wasn't there. It just felt off balance.
It really did. But they kind of got it back a little bit with Power Windows.
Yeah, I agree. Power Windows was definitely a lot more energetic and, I don't know, more focused, it seemed to me.
And then speaking of Rush in the 80s, when they put out the album Hold Your Fire, they had their one and only duet with Amy Mann of Till Tuesday.
Yeah.
Who was at?
She's done all three.
No.
She's done all three.
So she might be here tonight.
If she's not here tonight, I want a refund.
I think we're going to walk out.
Can I maybe talk to that guy and see if he can talk to them about getting my money back?
Your $10?
Yeah, $10. The service fee for the show, right?
Yeah. So she's been there all three nights.
She's done all three shows.
Well, good for her.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, hey, $10 is $10.
I wonder if she's getting scale for each show.
She had said that she made something like $2,500 to do that,
initially,
to do the vocal.
Yeah.
Yeah, when she initially recorded it.
Okay.
And maybe flown up there for like 3 days up in Toronto, and then... She says everybody was really nice. She said Neil was super serious.
She should have taken points on the record. You know, she should have taken points on the record versus...
She didn't know who they were.
Yeah. Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
How do you exist in the 80s in any musical landscape and not know anything about the band Rush? You know what I mean? Because they were just such a household name by the early 80s, you know? Like, unless you tried really hard to ignore... rock and roll music.
That's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah.
Mm. I felt like her vocal performance on there was really great. It was, for my wife, I think that's her favorite, one of her favorite Rush songs.
Okay.
Not her favorite, but one of her favorite. It's definitely one that shows the softer side of Rush.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. I agree. And, you know, my wife doesn't really have an opinion on Rush just yet, so I don't think I've forced her to listen to enough yet. So, yeah, she's a Duran Duran gal, so.
Not a bad band to like.
Not at all. We saw them several months ago. They're awesome. So, yeah, it's a great show.
Any other thoughts before we head into the Keogh Forum to experience what we hope is many surprises.
Many surprises. Yeah. Well, what I hope is that they choose not to ignore one of my early favorite records, Caress of Steel, and play something off it. Lakeside Park, Bastille Day. I'll settle for I Think I'm Going Bald, to be honest. I would love to hear something off that record, because they've never done anything off that record every time I've seen them.
So this is to be continued. This is part one. This is the preview. This is us just kind of reminiscing.
Exactly.
Take a little bit of a musical break.
Exactly.
And then we'll be back with part two, our reaction. Dan Reed, you and I just experienced 2 hours and 20 minutes of Rush
at
the LA Forum, also known as the Keogh Forum now.
Did you see all the pictures of all the bands that have played this grace this stage? The Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, Prince, The Who.
You know who's missing from that?
Who?
Rush.
That's hey, right.
How awesome is Rush? You have to say, dude, how awesome is
Rush? Dude, how awesome is Rush?
I just wanted to say, how awesome is Rush? They were so awesome. Good.
Amazing.
Oh, my God. Okay, so I saw them on their 2015 R40 tour, which was the last tour.
The retirement tour,
The retirement tour. I knew it was kind of it. That was sort of the last hurrah.
How did it feel? How did they feel when you saw them? Did it feel like they were
back
just
then?
Going through the yeah? Did
you feel no? Like I knew it was the end. I felt like that they were giving their all.
Yeah.
And they knew that this was it. So, yeah, but this, sense. Oh my God, what a comeback!
Absolutely. You know what? On drums, Annika, is that right?
Annika Niles. She's a German, 43-year-old German lady.
Saw
she's
some so footage good. Of her before. You know. Playing a smaller kit, and I'm like, how's she gonna achieve all this stuff that Neil had done on a tiny kit? And now I see that she has this big expanded kit because she took the job seriously, and she blew the doors off of the Forum. Everyone was cheering for her, and you could see that she saw it, and they were just, man, she was just incredible. And not just that, but that lit a fire under both of their asses. Oh. And they just, they were digging it, and they were moving and grooving and totally engaged the whole show.
When the musicians and the audience are in sync, because everything is just firing on all cylinders correctly, that's when you know you've got a great show ahead.
Exactly.
They opened with Xanadu.
Yep.
Not an easy song to play.
Absolutely difficult
and
song.
She fucking nailed
and
it.
And I think that's why they opened with it. I think they did that to show the crowd, if there was any doubt that she could do the job, that she came out and whooped ass on the very first 10-minute song, and any of the naysayers just better shut the fuck up.
Yeah, pretty much. And most of I don't think there were any naysayers.
I don't think there was any naysayers at all. Yeah. I think that there was just as many people cheering for Geddy and Alex as there were for her. It was just a group effort. Everyone
the,
was
the set list was for their 50-something year as a group. They picked really great songs to spotlight, and some they haven't played live in a very long time.
Yeah.
There's one in particular that you were super excited to hear. What was that?
I shed tears of joy. A Farewell to Kings.
Farewell to Kings.
Absolutely. You know, Farewell to Kings and Hemispheres are my two favorite records, and to hear two tracks off Farewell to Kings was amazing.
That was, you know, was pretty great.
And, you know, to be fair, there's always the, they could have done this, they could have done that, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, you go there and you see the energy they're putting into it. Even the songs that I wasn't that familiar with from the later albums still were fantastic. And they were playing with tons of energy. And she just breathed a lot of life into their performance.
I thought the tributes to Neil were really tasteful, too.
Man,
they were very nice.
They were incredible.
I was trying to figure out, like, how are they going to do this? Like, what exactly are they going to do? And what they did is they just presented it in his own words with some really great photos. And video enhancements.
Yeah.
And it was his turn in the spotlight.
Yeah.
But,
absolutely.
But that wasn't the only drummer they spotlighted.
That's right. When they did Working Man, they ended the show with Working Man. They spotlighted our good man, John Rutsey, who was their original drummer, the founding drummer. Yeah. And that was really, really beautiful to see, you know, that they respected and honored him as well. Because he was a member, and he was one of the guys that started the band. Yeah, that was incredible.
And they did it with the song Working Man, exactly. Which had a lot of great, just a nice video put together, yeah. But also some photos from mm-hmm. that era.
Yeah.
And just acknowledging, like you said, that this was the beginning of it. You
know? Yeah, absolutely. It was just a phenomenal show. Phenomenal.
I can't say enough good things about what they did, because I was initially leery about them going back out on the road. Yeah. I thought, oh man, they ended on such a great note, and why go back out on the road again? I know they really want to play. That was obvious.
Yeah.
But all of that hesitation that I expressed on a previous episode of this podcast mm-hmm. evaporated.
Right out the window.
Right out the window.
Like vapor trails.
Which they did not play.
See what they did right there?
Yeah, I saw what they did, but they didn't play anything off of Vapor Trails.
Yeah. Well, just like they didn't do anything off Fly By Night or Caress of Steel. But hey, again, you know, with such a vast catalog, you can't play something from every record, and you can't play every fan favorite, you know.
Another high point was that Amy Mann came out. She has been here for all four nights and sang Time Stand Still. Awesome. And it was a nice surprise. I thought that was just going to be on the first night.
And that was a beautiful video tribute to Neil that they did during that song. It was epic.
Very much so. I would say that the band has packed this show full of surprises. Whichever set list you experience, I think you're going to get a lot for your money.
Well, yeah, they're rotating four set lists, it looks like, and some bigger cities like Chicago and stuff, they're playing those four nights. Tonight, we had the pleasure of seeing all of 2112 in its entirety, which was absolutely amazing. That's never happened at any show I've been to of theirs, and this would have been my fourth one. So, yeah, incredible. So.
I saw them perform it in 1996, 97.
Yeah.
On the Test for Echo tour, they did that. And a little bit musician talk here, but they had to take it down a couple steps, as it were, so it could accommodate Getty's changing voice.
Yeah.
And then Neil had different drums at that point, so it even sounded different.
Yeah, and you know, to be honest, it sounded like almost everything was played in original key tonight, which was incredible. That just goes to show you the work that he put into getting his voice back into shape.
And that he was able to hit those notes on free will.
Yeah.
On free will. Dude. That goes way up there into the ceiling.
Yeah. You know, when I took my son to see him in 2011 on the Time Machine tour, that's one thing I had trouble with was his voice. It was tough because you could see that his voice was weakening and that he was losing that stamina, and he had to re-sing things a lot differently. And tonight it just didn't feel that way at all. He showed up and he played, you know, did all original vocal lines. I'd say probably 85% of them, you know what I mean, were all the original lines, which was incredible.
I don't want to spoil it too much, but it's kind of hard not to, because we just got out of the show and just...
We're just brimming with how you're doing. And what did I tell you towards the end of that? I said, I would love to see these guys record an album.
They may surprise us and
that. They might.
And as I was telling you in line, we're waiting for t-shirts or waiting to buy t-shirts, that Neil has lots of lyrics that he left behind.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly some finished, some unfinished. The way in which the band works is Neil writes the lyrics, Getty and Alex write the music.
Yeah.
And he obviously provides the drum parts.
Yeah.
It's something that I think that they could probably do. And you mentioned something about Billy Bragg and Woody Guthrie.
Yeah, the Billy Bragg Wilco Mermaid Avenue LPs. And Woody Guthrie's daughter had reached out to Billy Bragg and said, hey, I found all these lyrics of my dad's that he wrote while he was sick in the hospital before he died. Thousands of song lyrics. And so Billy Bragg went through them all and sorted them out and came up with a bunch, and he got Wilco together and they recorded those albums. And so if Neil has unused lyrics, this might be a great opportunity to do something new for the fans and include him as well.
And I know in the 11 years since they went into sort of hibernation hiatus, kind of quitting, kind of not, that Getty and Alex would often jam in Getty's basement, and he would record all those jams. So he has many hard drives full of those jam sessions where they can pull from. And I think that it's possible. You never know. It just, you know, it has to be the right thing for them to do.
Sure, exactly. So. And you know, this tour is going to last the next 6 months. It's going to be interesting to see what they do when they're done. If they just hang it up and that was a blast, great. If they say, you know what, we want to record some tunes, let's see how it goes, let's go in the studio, let's start jamming, that would be epic too.
They certainly have a talented drummer.
Absolutely.
To lay down some grooves there.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
She is just phenomenal.
Phenomenal. Just I can't say enough amazing things about her. She, as a drummer, you know, observing his style versus her style, Neil Peart is very meticulous in what he's playing. He mentions that he likes to play off the cuff a little bit and stuff too, but I felt like she played off the cuff a little bit more and wasn't quite as timekeeping as him. She was a little looser, and you could see where she was doing different fills when she was doing rolls, like they were different. You could get the vibe that she wasn't playing that same fill in that same spot every night, whereas Neil would play the same fill in the same spot every night.
There were certain fills that you just don't mess with.
No,
right?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. You're absolutely right, and yeah. She knows that. And
yeah, you could Tom see Sawyer, yeah. The end of Subdivisions. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I was surprised by the fact that she was able to nail most of those, but yes, branching out and showing that, like, here's how I would do it and sort of slightly reimagine it.
And as a drummer who improvs a lot of his fills anyway, I can appreciate that, because you don't always get to have the opportunity to play the same thing over and over and over. So you get what I'm saying, right?
I'm a little distracted because right now two women in thongs and heels and jackets are walking across the street.
It's just like, okay, all right, welcome to LA.
Gee, do you think they're dancers?
I think they might
be. They look like solid gold dancers.
Solid gold dancers. Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's see him dance to Tom Sawyer. What do you say?
I doubt that's going to happen.
I know. Yeah. I know.
Anyway, totally. Dan, I just wanted to thank you for your thoughts. I know that this is something that you really wanted to see, this show, this tour.
Ted, and I want to thank you for including me on this adventure. What an amazing experience, and so incredibly grateful to have been here and enjoyed the show with you. I mean, this is the first time you and I ever went to a show together. So
that's true. We've known each other since high school.
I know, since high school, and this is the first time we've seen a show together. So what more fitting show to wig out to together than Rush, right?
Yes.
I mean,
it was just really amazing. Well, I've got more to say on the other side of this, so I'll just say we're going to wrap this section up, and thanks again, Dan.
It's been a few days since the concert, and I'm still thinking about it, marveling at what an amazing night it was and what a fantastic performance the band delivered to an audience that was just so happy to be there and hear these songs played live again. I've seen Rush about 10 times since 1981, and this, I'm not kidding you here, was one of the finest performances I have ever seen. Partly, it's the thrill of seeing them on stage again. Partly, it's the power and precision of Annika Niles on drums, that Geddy Lee could hit all those notes from the 70s and 80s, and Alex Lifeson on guitar was just on fire. And partly, it's because the band delivered the goods at the beginning of the tour, when so much can go wrong. I gotta say, for the first hour of the concert, I had a huge smile on my face. People might have thought I was stoned or drunk or crazy, but it was pure happiness. And that's what I love about music. When humans play music for other humans, it's sometimes a pure form that, well, is sublime. I love it. Ah, well, okay. I think I've gushed about Rush enough. So thanks for listening. I'm Ted Astorgadu, and I'll be back soon with another episode of the Planet LP Podcast. Bye for now.